Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, July 12th. I'm Ray Graff. One of my favorite programs of the month is here. It's the Science Forum on Vox Pop. Today we welcome back our panel of experts to answer your questions. If you have a scientific question, call now, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. You can also email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. VoxPop@WAMC.org. But again, the number 800-348-2551. Science. It's all about science today on Vox Pop. We'll get to your calls right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. You know, every once in a while, we convene some of the great minds of our time to talk about important issues of the day. And I'm certainly not talking about the roundtable panel. I'm talking about Vox Pop, the Science Forum. And today is that day. We have brought together three brilliant scientists to talk about things that you want to talk about and even things you don't want to talk about. And we'll get to that in a minute. The number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But the number again, 800-348-2551. Now, let's have those scientists sign in, please.
First, Barbara Brabets. I am a professor of biochemistry at SUNY Cobleskill, and I'm here to answer your questions about biology and chemistry.
Very good.
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist and a journal editor, retired from GE Global Research.
What's the journal?
Polymer Degradation and Stability.
I read that at the barbershop.
Yeah.
That's good.
You'll find that in the doctor's offices down in the lower levels.
Really good stuff.
And Ed Stander, number three, I cover everything that the chemists refuse to touch.
Okay. And, you know, we talked about things you want to talk about and things you don't want to talk about. Well, I got to tell you, this is on everyone's lips. Every water cooler, they're talking about the synthetic lava. Jim Pickett, tell us about this stuff.
Yes. As I made the bad pun when we were bantering about this, much to my surprise, one of the hot spots for lava research is Syracuse University.
Of course,
where they have this very large crucible that they cook up batches of lava and study how it flows.
And this synthetic lava, it's the same stuff as real lava?
Yes, apparently they use basically the real thing.
So they take lava, they melt it, and they make lava out of it.
Well, they take
so it's not really synthetic lava; it's real lava.
Well, they
it's
they
reused
can
lava.
Yes, recycled lava.
Reduce, reuse, recycle. I'm all for reduce.
Yeah, and they can tweak the compositions and see how it flows and how the flows can be diverted or steered.
I mean, presumably you could study this stuff by actually going to a volcano.
Yes, I think the workman's compensation.
I'm thinking of the student health insurance.
Yes, yeah. It would increase doing too much of that.
And what do they hope to learn?
I think basically how it flows and
downhill.
How it flows downhill and how to divert it, steer
I've seen
it.
A couple of disaster movies. They just take those Jersey barriers and put them in the roads of L.A., and it moves the lava right into the ocean. I saw it on
you saw it on
a couple
TV?
Of different movies.
It must be
true. I can understand, too. I mean, if you had a choice of being in Hawaii or Syracuse, I mean, there's no question where I want to be.
I was thinking there was a hellmouth, but I'm not going to say anything.
A hellmouth in Syracuse?
In Syracuse.
Part of this, too, is that researchers and other places do similar kind of work on very small scale to be able to do lots of
they
experiments.
They put Lego men in it?
Yeah,
I don't know.
Maybe on the Lego houses. But then kind of those findings can be validated on this larger scale, and then you could go to Hawaii and validate it on the real thing.
How hot is lava?
It says here that, well, it depends on the type of lava.
Mm-hmm.
This one, they heat the furnace to 1,200 degrees Celsius, which would be
1,700, 1,800 Fahrenheit.
Yeah,
less than steel, actually.
Yeah, so this looks kind of like a steel or could be probably ceramic-lined steel crucible like they would make iron.
Interesting. Yeah, you got to keep the kids away from that, though, when it's hot, right?
Probably, yes.
Although
they
do.
They
it.
Do say, though, they get really great-looking objects out of this that they put on their mantelpieces and
sell it at the college
at
gift
the tour.
Store.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure you're probably aware that in Hawaii, you're not allowed to take the lava away from the
I
island.
Didn't know that.
They have dogs at the airport that supposedly can sniff out your pieces of lava that you're trying to take with you.
And apparently, if you take it away, you can have bad luck for over 7 years, according to Pele,
really?
Who's the god of fire. And as a result, they get about 11 tons of lava returned to Hawaii by post every year. So this is a way, I mean, this is Ooh. Syracuse lava, and as Syracuse lava is synthetic, it means Pele doesn't care. So it's probably a good thing.
It's like microplastics, right? It's not real stuff in the water. It's fake stuff.
Well, I've got to say, this has really eased my mind. This one came in via email. This is from Paul, and the subject heading is, question regarding bug splatter on windshield. Good afternoon. Maybe this is just my impression, but rainwater seems to get rid of bug splatter on my car windshield better than washer fluid. Is there something in rainwater that does a better job? Is it just the volume of water when it's raining and the wipers are running? Thanks. That's from Paul. In North Adams.
I think this is a first. I don't think we've had this question before.
All right. Boy. What do you think?
I would think that it would be the volume and probably the longer time to get it.
And the force. Because, you know, rain is hitting you at whatever speed you're driving.
Yes.
So.
And there really isn't anything in the spritzer stuff.
It's methanol. It's methanol and water. That's in blue or whatever color du jour.
We like
is
orange.
Orange? Yeah. You go with the bug stuff?
Yeah.
The orange stuff? They do in the orange stuff to make it not clear so it looks like Hi-C, they put in a little bit of oil.
Yeah.
So strangely, they put in this thing to make it look cloudy, kind of like they do with orange soda.
Well, I'll be darned.
So that actually defeats the purpose of getting the bugs off the windshield, but they call it a bug emollient or emulsifier.
So I think the bottom line here is it's not a matter of something that's in the rainwater, because rainwater is pretty darn pure.
Except acidic. It is, 5.8 on the pH scale.
But you put a lot more on it than if you're just spritzing the windows.
It's a matter of the time and the volume.
All right. Well, Paul, thank you for that one and getting us started here. Now let's go to the phones at 800-348-2551. Mark, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Hebron or Salem, New York.
Ah, Hebron. All right, you're on.
Okay. Well, first of all, let me say something about the pH of water. I had fish tanks for many years till my house burned, and I used to collect rainwater from the barn roof, which was slate, and I never measured pH above 7.2. So I was always expecting – I'm an atmospheric scientist by training – and I was always expecting it to be more acidic. And it was always alkaline. That's another question to throw out there. Why was it alkaline? The question I called about is that I have an older home with very steeply pitched roofs that are covered with metal, and I just installed 150 square feet of my own solar hot water collectors with copper pipes coming to ground. And I'm wondering if anybody there has a suggestion as to how I should ground that system against lightning. Should I put lightning rods up, or should I just ground the copper pipes to a earthen ground, or what would they suggest?
So what is grounded right now? Anything?
Well, it goes back to the plumbing system, but the plumbing system
is grounded.
Is hooked to a pump. And the pump goes through a plastic PVC pipe to the well.
But there's usually a really large gauge copper wire that's rammed into some kind of ground, either in the basement or right outside the foundation.
Well, I have my electrical system is grounded
in four
places. But my plumbing system, because of the plastic pipe, I've always kind of thought that it was sort of not appropriate, because when you ground everything to your plumbing and it goes through plastic, it's not really making a very good ground. And now I have this new system on, and I have some points where there's some inlets and things with points on them. Should I go ahead and ground that system separately from the rest of the system? Or, it's the old Benjamin Franklin argument. Does it attract lightning or does it dissipate it?
Right.
Yeah, well, if it were me, I would put two lightning rods up and then ground the lightning rods, because that's by far the simplest way to do it. And the lightning rods would then attract the spare electrons effectively and send them down to ground before you ever had a problem with your system.
I see Jim nodding.
I think that's a reasonable.
And it's not very hard to put
in. Should I hook that into the copper as well?
Well, if the copper is not grounded, it wouldn't do you much good. Yeah. It should go go directly into a, a 4 or 6 AWG into the ground.
But it sure can't hurt to ground everything.
Ground everything, yeah, because they talk about stray currents from grounding different things in different places. And as I said, I've already got a number of grounds down. I'm sort of at a complete loss as to what is the best thing to do.
You may want to check with an electrician before you do anything.
Well, I have a similar thought.
They don't know either.
Well, there are some of these lightning rod companies that will come out and do this for you, and they'll give you a guarantee that the system that they put in will not short your house out. So I don't know if they'll do that with solar panels, but given the fact that so many solar panel systems are on roofs these days, it seems like a market. So, you know, having that kind of assurance or that everything is grounded the way you want it grounded may be worth that little extra money.
All right, Mark, thanks a lot for the call. You know, I hear about this metal roof, and the first thing I think of is loading it up as a receive antenna for shortwave. Get an antenna tuner. I'll bet you get great reception.
Huh, you think? But don't they have to be directional?
You'd have two.
Oh,
so they would
say,
be a phased array of some kind, wouldn't it?
Yeah, right.
Oh, and if it's grounded, if you've got a good ground into it as well, that would even be better.
All right. So maybe he'll, get up a little shortwave receiving station there. And
get some Ukrainian music.
Report back. There's not much music on shortwave anymore.
It's mostly Christian stations from down south.
All right. Let's go to the break now. 800-348-2551 is the number. 800-348-2551. The Science Forum. We'll be back.
Support comes from the Lake George Land Conservancy, Bolton Landing, New York, working on land protection projects that safeguard the water quality of Lake George. Hiking maps, public events, and more at lglc.org. Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York, specializing in distinctive eyewear, including Zenka from Paris and Coco Song from Italy. And prescription and non-prescription sunglasses. Eye exams by appointment, EYEDENTITY Eyewear, Albany.com. The Tang Teaching Museum and Art Gallery at Skidmore College. Celebrating France's Day, a community open house with tours, art making, music, and more, Saturday, July 14th, 2 p.m. to 6 p.m., skidmore.edu/tang for details. From Nine Pin Cider, Albany, hard cider made from local apples, Tasting Room features New York cider, beer, wine, spirits, open Tuesday through Sunday, now available in Massachusetts and Connecticut. NinePinCider.com. And from Patricia Dalton Fennell and Albany Health Management Associates, for over 30 years, working to bridge the arts, science, and service, working globally and locally, AlbanyHealthManagement.com.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. It's the Science Forum. Ed Stander, Jim Pickett, and Barbara Brabitz are the scientists. You at home ask the questions. That's how this program works. 800-348-2551 is the number. Let's go over to Frank in Woodstock. Frank, you're on.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question is about something I heard was discovered or invented in the University of Manchester, and it has to do with molecular mapping and where a carbon atom is mapped and to create that creates a product called graphene. Can you comment on any about that and coming to the United States?
Okay. What graphene is basically a single layer of graphite. And in fact, you can make it at home by if you have a little chunk of graphite and put scotch tape on the top, pull it off, you pull off a layer of graphene. There's been a great deal of research in the last 10 years or so on graphene, on making it, on thin layers on surfaces and manipulating it in various ways. As far as I know, nothing very practical has come out of that yet. It's still kind of in, a lot of it is in the hype stage.
Kind of theoretical thought exercises of what could be.
Right. Or something is done very heroically on a teeny tiny scale. Go ahead.
I heard someone make a bicycle that weighed a pound and a half.
I would be skeptical about that.
A clown bicycle?
Yeah. That this single layer material is very strong for a single layer material, but it is a single layer material. Yeah. So, you know, it itself is much, much stronger than most anything else of that given thickness. But to actually make it into something that's practical has remained a huge challenge. It's like the nano rods of carbons and buckyballs and all of that. Anytime that something kind of new is discovered, there's this huge flurry of activity and big claims, and you have to see what comes out the other end. And it's usually something, but not a lot.
All right, Frank, thanks a lot for the call. The number here on the Science Forum is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. We'll go over to David in Red Hook. David, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Think about all of the nasty chemical solid waste that has been created and threatens our environment, our watershed, our wells, all that kind of stuff we're all afraid of. I'm wondering what would happen if we took helicopters with big, huge sacks of all of this batteries and, you know, all of the stuff we don't know what to do with and it piles up, and we just flew it over an active volcano and just dropped it all in the volcano for the molten earth to reabsorb, not a volcano that's spewing like all over Hawaii, but one that's just going to churn it all up and melt it down and then bring it back into the earth as a disposal method. What would happen with batteries? Or you think out loud of all the nasty stuff you know of, and what would happen if we chucked in a volcano?
Believe it or not, David, this is not the first time this has come up on the show.
I think it came up last month. Yes. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's
fine. They've had a lot of time to think about it.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a couple problems with it. One of the problems is that volcanoes, generally speaking, exude stuff. They don't take stuff in. If you put the stuff in a volcano, it's going to come out sooner or later if it's active. First of all, if the stuff is getting in there, it's going to wind up melting. It's going to wind up coming out in the ash. It's going to wind up coming out in the vapor that comes out of the top. And
see, one of the rules of chemistry, as a general rule, is the law of conservation of matter. If I stick carbons and hydrogens in, they'll still be carbons and hydrogens once they're in there. They may change how they're bonded. So it could go from like a battery, which is polymer and some lead and some acid, and become carbon, but it'll still be lead and it'll probably still be acid. So yeah. It hasn't really changed that much.
It doesn't look like
a battery.
Earth, isn't it?
What's that?
It would be more safely stored in the molten lava, presuming it stays in the earth, in the molten level of the earth, as opposed to where we currently have it, water and threatening our lives in some environmental way.
Well, think of what we do with a landfill. We think that we bury it so that it's out of our circulation.
But
what we found out is that it doesn't do that. It's still in our circulation because our circulation is more geological than it is biological.
A volcano actually seems like a better place to store it than a landfill.
Well, a volcano isn't just a hole down to the mantle of the earth. But if the volcano isn't active,
you can't put anything in it.
you can walk around on top of it.
I'm talking about the molten part.
Yeah.
Well, if it's molten, then it's erupting.
And therefore, it's coming out onto the earth, so it makes it very difficult to get rid of it.
So one of the things we talked about last time was incineration as a means of getting rid of our municipal waste. We get to control the temperature. We get to control the oxygen content. We get to control what happens to the waste when it's done burning. And in the meantime, we can also generate electricity with that municipal solid waste. And that is done in a lot of places where there's not enough space for the landfilling. And unfortunately, this is more than a science experiment. This is more about an economics experiment. think of taking our trash by helicopter and transporting it around. How much is your monthly bill going to be? Say it's $35 a month now to get rid of your waste. How much is it going to be if there's transportation to the volcanic center and then we have helicopters moving it? It's going to get expensive. So ultimately, this becomes an economic issue.
How about the most nasty, dangerous material? We filter it out. It's just that kind of stuff.
Incineration is still better.
We can't incinerate because of whatever laws. Like, what kind of materials are there like that, besides like radioactive nuclear waste? Is there anything that qualifies for...
If you drop stuff in a volcano, it's going to come out sooner or later in one form or another. If you put it in an incinerator, you have some sort of control over the environment. But in a volcano, you've got no control whatsoever.
And from a heavy metal standpoint, say we're throwing in heavy metals, chromium, I'm trying to think of what... Not radioactive waste, but heavy stuff like lead, right, which we know has a health effect. We can reclaim that from the incinerator. Mm-hmm. We can't do that in the volcano.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot. We have to move it along, David, but thank you for the very interesting call. Our number is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. The Science Forum today on Vox Pop. Jason in Chatham. Jason, you're on. Hello.
I'm a freshly retired science teacher, and this year for the first time I had students actually, and I love when they question things that we just tell them, but they're claiming that the Earth is not spherical, that it's flat. And supposedly Kyrie Irving, who plays for the Celtics, told them in a YouTube thing, and now all the boys believe it because a professional basketball player said it. And when I went over and I read an article in the New Yorker about this, I'm like, we dispelled this one and we dispelled this one. And it's like, is it even worth discussing? Or, I mean, I always feel it's worth discussing, trying to convince anyone, but it becomes a question of, are we wasting time?
Well, actually, most basketballs are flat. I don't know if you've noticed.
Very good. Very
but they're sort of flat. There's no curvature to them whatsoever.
Yeah.
There's
about
actually
pressure inside the Earth would make it spherical, yes.
There's actually a website that takes a very close-up view of a basketball and shows that it appears to be flat, and then it blows out, and then you see it's a basketball. And it's in response to this exact thing.
Okay.
So all you need to do is, we've got a couple of eclipses that are coming up. All you need to do is to point at what the shadow of the Earth looks like upon an object, whether it be the moon, any day, or the sun. There's the curvature of the Earth right there.
Yeah, and what people have been doing
They would claim that that is from a Frisbee-shaped Earth and not a spherical Earth.
Oh, well, the way to deal with
that's
that.
That's how the flat earthers, and they do the silly thing. They put water inside the Frisbee and say, see? Now, if you put water on a ball, it runs off, and I'm like, I go nuts thinking, you remember we talked about gravity, right? And it was, it's quite funny if it weren't so sad.
Well, what some people have been doing, especially science teachers, is they've been making connections with other science departments around the world. And there's a whole website as well for doing this. And they go outside at noon and they measure their shadow. And based on that, they can figure out, using Eratosthenes' measurements.
Eratosthenes' method. Yeah. We looked at that and we talked about that as well. And I still got, well, from very few kids at that point, because they saw that there was no, you know, escaping it. But a couple of kids are still saying, nope, I believe the Earth is flat.
So maybe they should join the Flat Earth Society then.
Well, I think that's the whole, that's what's going on.
I don't even think that the people in the Flat Earth Society believe in the Flat Earth. I just think they're contrarian.
True. I think it's oppositional defiance in a way. You can also do it talking about the volume of that Frisbee and versus the volume of the Earth, and then measure what the circumference is, and you can see the difference.
And you can ask the simple question, if the Earth is flat, how come no one has seen the edge?
Huh.
I mean, sooner or later.
So ask an explanation for that, too, but it gets way conspiracy theory.
All right. Well, maybe we'll have Kyrie Irving on one of these days. Hey, thanks a lot, Jason. We appreciate the call very much. It's the Science Forum, and the number is 800-348-2551. Before we get to the next call, this one came in from Sandra, and she says, you know, I noticed that in the first discussion, one of you converted Celsius to Fahrenheit instinctively. I have two related questions. Why do you think that the U.S. has not changed to implementing the metric system And do you think that if we were teaching our students metric at an early age, they would be better at math and science? Why I ask this is because converting within metric is so easy and within imperial is confusing. And that's from Sandra.
I don't even know how many bushels are in a peck. So imperial is confusing. I think as scientists, we have to be ambidextrous and move back and forth between English units and SI units, the so-called metric units. We get a feel for them with kind of benchmarks along the way when it comes to temperature, for example, or kilometers. But, you know, the 9/5 business, that comes up between the difference in Fahrenheit and Celsius, so you can kind of do a rough estimate.
All right.
Yeah,
so, they tried to do that in the 70s, right? They forced that down our throats, and I think that's what Americans got upset about. How dare you, imperialists, tell us what to do?
Yeah. Canada did it, and they still have it.
Well, good for them.
And I tell you, freshmen in college still don't know the metric system, even though they've had it since second grade. They learn it enough to get past the unit, and then they give it up.
Yep, and American engineers have clung to the imperial system.
Oh, my gosh, BTUs. Yeah. British thermal units, come on. Horsepower?
We crashed a satellite into Mars by doing that.
Yeah. Right. Somebody didn't do the right conversion in the programming.
I think, though, in current engineering training is more and more metric.
Well, when the fundamentals of engineering exam goes to metric, then we know that engineers are there. But so far, the FE exam is still in imperial units.
Yeah.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum with Barbara Brabets, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander. And let's go to Fred in Ballston Spa. Fred.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
I've been puzzled by the fact that the Bronze Age followed the Stone Age rather than the Iron Age following the Stone Age. Bronze is an alloy of two elements, usually with a copper base. Discovering how to make bronze appears more complicated than developing iron ore. That is probably more recognizable in nature and more available. Can you comment on this?
Okay.
Well, there's a temperature difference that's going to make a huge difference if you're trying to make things. Bronze, one of the nice things about bronze is that it melts at a much lower temperature than iron, which allows you to produce things like, actually to work it as well. Iron is a much more brittle material than bronze as well. So if you can produce bronze, you've got a benefit right there, right from the start.
So kind of like campfire versus forge, right?
Exactly.
I mean, you can make bronze in a campfire.
And you can work it much, much easier as well. So it's much more malleable.
What about the fact that copper and iron can cohabit the same types of rock?
Yeah, and also the fact that copper occurs as the metal.
That's true.
In places. And the Bronze Age evolved out of earlier technology that was more pure copper.
There is a copper age before the Bronze Age.
So it was discovered that as you adulterate the copper with other stuff,
it melted at a lower temperature.
Yeah, and was harder and was better. So it evolved out of the copper, which could in places you can just pick up out of the ground.
Yeah,
and back in the old days, if you wanted iron, you effectively had to find meteorites because that was the only true source. Otherwise, you would have to blast it out of soil, and that's a very, very high energy job to do.
Right. I mean, that's a commitment to build a forge and then run a forge to get to the point where it melts and is pure and reduced.
All right. Well, thanks, Fred. We appreciate the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Before we head to break here, let's tackle an email or two. And this one is from Ryan, who writes, when oil gets extracted from the earth, does that affect the amount of heat that comes from the core of the planet? In other words, does the oil in the ground act as a buffer or insulation that mediates the heat from the core of the earth? And that's from Ryan.
Well, first of all, all that oil is effectively coal that has been put under low temperature for a very long period of time.
How low?
Gosh, a good question. I'm not quite sure what temperature it goes to. But
isn't salt a part of that, too? Doesn't there need to be salt?
No, the salt traps it. Ah. The reason why the oil doesn't get to the surface is because it usually occurs at about the same places where the salt is coming up from below. But the temperature is quite low, and as a buffer, there's just not enough material there to actually make a difference. We're talking, you know, very, very small percentage of the Earth actually has oil on it. So I can't see where it would have much of an effect. And, of course, the oil coming to the surface is not hot. It's been this stuff has been produced over hundreds of thousands of years or millions of years, and when it comes out in a gusher, it's at the temperature of the rock, not anything higher or lower.
So does coal need a significantly higher temperature and pressure, or
it's mainly temperature and pressure. What happens is you've got in the Earth, you've got places where heat from the core effectively is coming up as a mantle plume, and that heats up the material underneath it, and that's where the oil comes from. And the reason why it occurs in places like the North Sea and such is because these are places where, along with the coal, there's also a lot of salt. And so as the pressure of the Earth above pushes down on it, the salt actually comes up, forms a diapere, and that crushes the rock above it, which makes traps for the oil to be trapped in.
Mm.
So what people do when they're looking for oil is they look for the salt deposits, and the salt deposits then tell them where the oil is.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum, 800-348-2551. Back in a moment with more of your calls and your emails.
Support comes from the Lake George Association, investing now to help keep Lake George waters clean for future generations. LakeGeorgeAssociation.org. Watercolors by Edith, Shutesbury, Massachusetts. Edith Hunsberger, a painter in acrylic and watercolors, specializing in portrait paintings of people and pets from photographs. Edith-Hunsberger.artistwebsites.com. Dr. Lucy Chapik, Latham, New York, a plastic surgeon dedicated to aesthetic cosmetic surgery. Procedures including fat transfers, facial rejuvenation, breast augmentation, and laser and skin care since 1996. 518-786-1700. From the Nature Conservancy's Adirondack Chapter, working to preserve freshwater resources that flow from the Adirondacks to New York's urban centers. nature.org/Adirondacks. And from Interactive Media Consulting, a team of online market strategists, providing websites, branding, and digital marketing to the Capital Region and beyond since 1996. imediaconsult.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here, and the number is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum today. Jim Pickett, Barbara Brabets, and Ed Stander are the scientists. Jim, you have your journal open to something else here. What is that?
It's one of your favorite topics.
What's that?
Slime.
Slime. Oh, you know, thank you. Thank you for bringing that up. One of you said the way to get rid of the slime that all my children bring home is vinegar.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tried it.
Yeah.
It took a long time.
Well, it still would have worked.
It did work.
Yeah.
It just took. I put it in. I expected a fast reaction.
Oh, you millennial people, you.
Wait. Millennial?
That was a compliment.
Oh, that's
He's not 1,000 years old yet.
But it took it took a while, though, but it worked.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Yeah. Sorry about the time delay on that. But no, this is just kind of a general comment in that we were discussing a little of the chemistry of slime last month. And it turns out that it's still controversial.
Why?
Well, because one is that it's pretty complicated. And it is probably not exactly one. Here's what we were talking about. To make slime, you have Elmer's glue, which is mostly a long chain polymer called polyvinyl alcohol.
Okay.
And you have borax. And the borax binds onto the polyvinyl alcohol to make what's called crosslinks between these chains and turns a liquid into the slime.
Mm-hmm.
The question that came up is, what's the nature of those links,
how
they go together? And that's still not perfectly clear after all this time.
So my children were doing experiments all that time. They were annoying me. That's amazing.
And if you happen to have a boron 11 nuclear magnetic resonance spectrometer at home,
it's in the garage.
You could do cutting edge research on it.
I'll put that on the list. This one came in via email. This is from Mark. Dear Science Panel, I've always heard that if you take any group of women and have them begin living together, that eventually each of the menstrual cycles will start to synchronize. Is this true or is it a myth? And if it's true, what is the science behind it? And that's from Mark.
It can be true, and it's hormones, baby.
Oh, really?
It's pheromones. It's actually chemical signals that one body puts out to the other. And this seems to be a tribal remnant. This happens in other populations, other pack animals, dogs, for example, elephants, even lions. So they will get so that the cycles align so that the care of, if you think about it from a like a tribal perspective, so that the births will all happen at about the same time within a year. Because if you're going to be burdened down, being, again, tribal, with children, babies in a time where you're trying to move with the flock or move with the herds or, you know, some basic agrarian societies, you want to kind of pool all your efforts together, kind of take a village to raise a child. So anecdotally and scientifically, there is definite evidence that women will cycle together. And funny, there's a lot of research into which one they will align with. So is there an alpha female of the group?
And have they found
that
out?
They've found out that you can have two alphas. And then the unfortunate thing is if you have one female woman who is not as dominant as either of the two alphas, she'll cycle twice a month.
No way.
So the poor woman has a period every 14 days. So she's cycling with both of these diametrically opposed cyclers.
Amazing.
Isn't that crazy?
Those are called bicyclers, right?
Yeah, you see what he
it's
did.
It's called a crazy dorm room, let me tell you.
Oh, I can tell you what. I'm sorry Mark asked. Let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. Kellen in Glens Falls. Kellen, you're on.
Hi, I would... first off, I want to say I'm a big fan of Kyrie Irving.
Oh, there you go.
For his basketball prowess?
Yes. More for his athletic ability, not his scientific ability.
Right.
I read a science book one time, and you'll have to forgive me. I forget the exact process of creating nuclear energy, but the two outcomes, it seemed like, if I remember correctly, was the nuclear energy we use at the facilities now, and then there was another energy option that was available. And I think it started with like a TH. I think it was like called thorium or something like that. I was wondering if you folks knew what I was talking about. And the book was interesting because it talked about how it cleaned better and how it was less hazardous, less dangerous to use. And I was just trying to get your thoughts on that.
Well, there is such a thing as a thorium fuel cycle to run nuclear reactors. Barb has just pulled it up on the font of all knowledge.
Well, this one's Wiki. Yeah. So we're, you know, I'm only going by Wikipedia, but thorium, let's see here. It's a nuclear reactor fueled primarily by the nuclear fission of uranium-233 produced from thorium. So thorium breaks down to uranium-233, which then breaks down and gives you the power source there. The reason why you go with that is that there's a lot more thorium available in our ore than there is uranium. It's easier to get to the thorium than it is to get to the uranium. And when you use uranium as your source, usually there's some enrichment that needs to happen or some separation of the different isotopes.
What's the atomic weight of thorium?
It's in the 230s.
Okay.
So don't have that one
it's
memorized.
It's above that of uranium.
Yes.
No, it's below.
It's below.
It's right at... So there's different isotopes. So you can have, so there's atomic number, which is how many protons you have. And then there is atomic mass, which is how much you weigh total with neutrons and protons. So there are different uraniums. There's 233, 235, 238. And thorium similarly has similarly weighted items.
But on the periodic chart, I believe it's two down.
It's two down, right.
From uranium.
But about the same mass.
But it's a matter, I think the uranium cycles are inherently safer reactors, and I think they generate different kind of waste. I don't believe they generate plutonium, for example.
Right, correct.
Which is one of the reasons that they weren't done first, because in the Cold War era, we wanted to generate
plutonium, sure.
There was, in the 80s or early 90s, there was a group of scientists from Georgia Tech that were looking into trying to use thorium reactors as a kind of a push to go that way in order to get off of fossil fuel. So we don't really look at nuclear right now as a society as a way to bridge our dependence on fossil fuel to an alternative energy system, because of the inherent problems and the scale up and the cost. And and this small group of scientists was saying, let's go to thorium reactors for a little while to get us off of fossil fuels and allow it to bridge us to a carbon, non-carbon source for our energy. So that was their idea. Not that it was the end-all be-all of energy, but that it would get us to where we need to go, take the training wheels off after a while and then be on alternative fuels.
You ready to go back to the phones here? Let's go to David in Goshen. David, you're on.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Well, I'm driving and my hearing aid batteries are dying, but you pulled a pet peeve of mine before.
Okay.
And associated the Celsius thermometer with the metric system. Metric system is base 10, Celsius is base 100. And I love Fahrenheit, and I'm an old dumper, and I remember 40 years ago when I was in high school, they talked about converting to the metric system, and I love the metric system, but I hate Celsius.
Well, if you, David, I don't want to parse too much, but you notice I use the SI rather than metric, which is this the standard. So when I talked about Celsius, I used SI, and then I kind of said metric in air quotes on the radio because that's what people hear. Mm. So I understand the difference between the two, but Celsius is one of the SI units of temperature. The other one's Kelvin.
Okay.
I love Fahrenheit because the degrees are smaller, it's more precise, everybody's used to it, and if you really want to be scientific, should we be using Kelvin?
Yes, we should be using Kelvin. What's the temperature? It's 71 degrees Fahrenheit here. What's the temperature, Kelvin?
It's about 403.
I like it around 402.
303.
303, yeah. Sorry.
Okay, well, hey, David, thanks a lot for the call, and good luck with the batteries.
Do you know where the Fahrenheit scale came from?
Fred Fahrenheit.
Well, Fred Fahrenheit, and he effectively said that these are the temperatures that we'll never reach. So 0 degrees was the coldest we were ever going to get, and 212 was the hottest we were ever going to get in the laboratory. So it's a great system if that's the system that we're using. But we've gone sort of past that in both directions.
All right. And over to Richard and Sharon Springs. Richard.
Yes. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Yes.
You're on. Yes.
Thank you. Okay. Well, I'm an environmental solutionist.
All right.
Okay. And earlier you were talking about slime. Am I correct?
Yes.
They have this slime growing in ponds. All right. Here's what I would do if I had a pond with slime. And this is even a big one, like the Okeechobee down in Florida.
Yeah.
You pump it up into the air and catch it in a filter underneath as the water falls down. Then you haul it away. This leaves the water dripping through the slime back into the source, and you catch the slime. I don't know what the holdup is. Doesn't this make sense to anyone?
It's a different slime.
Yeah, we were talking about a different slime. We were talking about the slime the kids make.
I'm talking about the stuff that's growing in these lakes and that have the wildlife in trouble. And and this is not just, in Florida. It's happening any place where, there's enough bacteria to grow slime.
Yeah.
So at any rate, I'm putting that out. And if you want to pass it on, it's a viable idea. And I'm happy to help save the world.
Hey, thanks.
Next question.
We appreciate it, buddy.
Who's going to pull the alligators out of the
Slime?
The fixture when they get stuck in there? Well, I'm not volunteering.
Well, that was
a
good one. Thank you, Richard, for that. And over to Ann. Ann in Saugerties, you're on.
Hello.
Hello.
I was wondering, because I was recently told that I have a sensitivity to iridium. Now, when I first started feeling sick, I was living in a place where the rocks were standing right on their side, and this little cottage was built right on top of this hill, which was made of rocks that were on their side. And I was wondering if iridium escapes up through those rocks, because here and near the Hudson, there are a lot of rocks that way, where I don't know when that happened, but the rocks are standing right on their side. And where it is that I would be picking up iridium.
Okay, iridium is rare stuff.
Iridium comes in from outer space. There's almost no iridium on the Earth.
Yeah, don't we use it as a marker for when big meteors hit us?
Yeah, if there's an iridium anomaly, which there is, for example, I wouldn't go to Cambria in Italy if I were you. Where there's an iridium anomaly, it usually means that a very large meteorite hit the Earth. Otherwise, iridium comes in, but on very, very low amounts every day from the space.
Are you sure you're not confusing iridium?
Really?
Iridium with radon?
Radon?
No. No.
Because iridium.
I was told iridium. And that I was told that it is used for in the glue that seals up bones. When you have a broken bone, they put a glue in there. Because I was asked if I had ever had a bone glued.
Wow.
And no, I haven't.
Yeah, because iridium is a very rare element that is kind of in the platinum group of metals.
Yeah.
Right, and it's so rare, it has no commercial use.
Yeah.
It's so expensive to mine it and purify it that it would be like coating yourself with diamonds.
On top of that, being able to prove, have somebody actually come to you and tell you have an iridium problem means that they have to actually have the iridium to test you with, which is very, 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 very unlikely.
Ann, I think you better get a second opinion on that one. But thank you very much for the call. And let's go over to Nancy in Ganzevoort. Nancy, you're on.
Hi, Ray.
Hello.
And guests. I'm calling about the slime that my granddaughters have been making for months and months on end. And I have it on the carpet, so they're no longer allowed to play upstairs, of course. Now it's a basement activity.
Yeah.
But I have tried. I've gone online. I've looked up remedies for that. And I've tried WD-40. I've tried vinegar. I've tried a whole list of different ingredients to try to get that off the rug. And nothing is working.
Well, I hate that stuff too, Nancy.
Yeah.
Borax, glue.
No, don't add.
It has shaving cream.
Do not add any more glue, and certainly do not add any more borax. You're just making more slime when you do that.
Yeah.
Right. I'm just trying to get it off the carpet.
Yeah.
Sort of cutting a patch out.
I'm with you.
Well, Ray can relate his firsthand knowledge that it.
Yeah.
Takes a while with vinegar.
But the thing is, though, I did it as a controlled experiment. We had slime, which I put in a cup and then
with
poured vinegar in.
Ah.
I didn't put it on the carpet. I'm sure the vinegar would also cause trouble for the carpet as well.
Not really, actually. No.
So you could just leave the vinegar on there.
Most carpets are what, nylon and what?
Polyester.
Polyesters. Rayon. So they really won't, no. It won't be nearly as destructive to the carpet. Maybe to the dye. You have to test it in an area where you can hide it under a sofa to make sure that the color isn't going to come out of the carpet. But if you were to soak it with vinegar and then take, your commercial rug cleaner that you get from your big box store and then hot water the heck out of it with the vinegar on it, you're going to get it out.
How about if you use citric acid instead?
Okay. Well, it's been there. It's probably been there for a month now.
Yeah.
And it's rock hard, And of course, it's turquoise blue on a beige carpet. So.
Sorry to be laughing, Nancy, but it's like the cluster of all the problems.
We feel your pain.
And kids think it's cute. And it's only cute when your kid goes over to another parent's house and then they make it there and bring it home. And then that's funny stuff.
Yeah.
But when it's at your house, not so much fun.
Jim,
not
what,
so much.
What about
and the new rule is that it doesn't go home with them. It has to stay at Nana's now because, you know,
it's Nana's fault. Oh, that's so typical. Hey, Nancy, good luck with that.
Call us back and let us know how your turquoise experiment goes.
So you think vinegar?
I think soak it in vinegar and then hot shampoo it with one of those rug shampooers.
Yeah. Yeah, the hot water is probably going to help.
Okay, I will try that.
Okay, very good. One question here. We have about 15 seconds, 20 seconds. This came in via email. Is all the lead in the world the result of decay of radioactive elements, or was some lead created as is?
I would say both.
Yeah, there's always been lead. In fact, lead is the most common element effectively on the face of the earth.
Yeah, but
by mass.
A lot of it is from the radioactive decay chain because lead is at the end. So everything that was radioactive pretty much
becomes lead
sooner or later.
And then our sun is a second generation sun, and so it needed a first generation sun to make lead in the second sun that we see up in the sky.
So our sun is the sun of a sun.
Yes.
Yep.
It's the sun of a sun.
But there would have been some original lead, just like there's original elements that are lower atomic number.
That's why we call it sunny, actually.
That is why we end the program, because it's getting confusing. Support comes from Capital Car Share, a nonprofit car sharing network in the Capital Region, offering neighborhood transportation with a fleet of eco-friendly vehicles. CapitalCarShare.org for donations and information. Vermont Coffee Company, organic coffee in the brown paper bag, now roasted with renewable energy. Vermont Coffee Company, coffee roasted for friends. Careers in Transition, LLC, Albany. Dr. Tom Denham, providing individual career guidance, career testing, job strategies, interview preparation, LinkedIn lessons, resume and cover letter writing, accepting new clients, careersintransitionllc.com. And George Propane, Goshen, Massachusetts, family owned and operated for over 75 years, serving Western Massachusetts with propane and full service heating and plumbing installation, services and deliveries, georgepropane.com. Thanks again to Barbara, Jim, and Ed for being here. Thank you for listening. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. Zach Malloy at the controls. Deb Malik took the calls. Tomorrow, on Food Friday, we talk about grilling seafood. Right now, stand by for news.